Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Questions from the Audio Road. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford, and I'll be taking your calls and answering your questions for the next hour or so. Lisa is here with us, screening calls and keeping things light and fun. If you want to join in, simply press 1 on your phone, and Lisa will be right with you. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. Sit back, relax, and listen, or jump in and ask your question. You can even bring us your opinion. It's up to you. This is your show. You can ask questions about fuel mileage, tires, engine, EGR, aerodynamics, truck specking, maintenance, taxes, financial planning, getting started as an owner-operator, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the audio road.
Hi, this is Lisa. Remember to talk to Kevin, press 1 so I can pick up the phone and screen your call. You know you'd rather talk to me anyway. Or just sit back, relax, and listen to the show. And at any time you have a question, just hit 1 and I'll pick up the phone.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Lisa's here screening your calls. Like she said, just press 1 if you want to jump into the conversation. I'm going to start off tonight with the market demand index, what's going on with freight and rates, and then we're going to get right to your calls and see what it is you want to talk about. You know, I used to do the market demand index and the rates when they updated on the live show, and it just seems like during the week that I just don't have enough time to get to a lot of these features. I like to do as many calls as I can on the live show. So I thought I'd get back to doing this, keep you up to date on what's going on in the market. Now, on the market demand index, this comes from the Internet Truck Stop Trans Forecast Letter. Comes out every week. I've been tracking this for a couple years. If we go back to mid-08, this index peaked at 13. And just to give you an idea, the number itself doesn't mean anything. It's an index that we need to see the history of it to know what's going on with it. The higher the number, the better it is for us, the guys with the capacity, the people with trucks. The lower the number, the worse it is for us, the better it would be for shippers as far as supply and demand goes. The market demand index this week is actually up 14% from last week. That's a pretty big climb. We're up to 4.88. Now, that's the highest the number has been in over a year. We were down almost all through 09, down under 2 for a big part of the year. Prior to that, we were down in the 1s. I mean, the index really got low. So 4.88 is a pretty good number. Now, the way they come to that index is by taking the available loads and comparing it against the available trucks. So the number, the index, could go up one of two ways. If load availability goes up, the index will go up, or if truck availability goes down, the index will go up, or both things can happen and the index will go up even more. This was one of those weeks. Load availability was up 11% and truck availability was down 3%. Add the two together and you roughly get the 14% increase that we saw for the week. That should normally affect rates, and it should affect rates positively, but we're not necessarily seeing normal patterns right now, and we haven't been for quite some time when it comes to what's going on with the index and what's going on with rates. The overall equipment rate is down 6% to $1.55 from $1.64. Reefer rates were down 9% to $1.55. Specialized rates down 12% to $1.86. Van rates down 1% to $1.37. And flatbed was up 4% to $1.43. I don't expect the rates to follow the index short term, meaning week to week. There's usually a lag. But there's also a really interesting trend going on overall in demand and rates right now, and it just has a lot to do with this economy and what's going on. I want to go over some numbers now. We were just comparing week over week, this week to last week. Now I want to compare this week to what was going on this week of last year. And we start to see some pretty interesting trends. If we look at the spot market load index, what's going on with loads? January of 2010 over January of 2009. Let's compare January against January. The spot market load index is up 66%. The spot market truck index, January over January, is down 30%. So we've got a big swing both ways. And that's good news. I mean, the freight is heading in the right direction, and the number of trucks are heading in the right direction, as long as you're not one of them that's going out of business. But the rates just aren't following. If we break it down by dry van load to truck ratio, that's taking available trucks and available loads and coming up with what's going on with the demand. In January of 2010 compared to January of 2009, dry van load to truck ratio is up 131%. Rates, they're flat. They're actually down 0.6% on the year-to-year comparison. And that is very unusual to see demand change as much as that and rates just stay flat. And I think a part of it is because we've been so depressed in this economy with rates that there are still a lot of people hauling for less than they need to. I think that the shippers and the brokers are getting a break because nobody realizes yet rates should be coming up. And that hopefully will start to change sometime soon. If we look at reefer load to truck ratio, up 70%, which is good for the year, or January against January, I should say, rates are actually down 2%. If we look at flatbed load to truck ratio is up 273%. That's wonderful. If you're looking for a flatbed load, it should be much easier to find, although rates are down 2% over last January. Now, some of the rates can have something to do with fuel and the fuel surcharge, but we still should start to see a swing in rates. I just think it's going to take longer this time. Just because the economy is so bad and so uncertain, and we just really don't know what's going on. If you want to join us, raise your hand here in the room. Press 1 if you want to talk about whatever you want. We're going to get to calls. Press 1, Lisa will screen your call, and we'll get to you on the air here. I'm going to start off in Tennessee. Let's see, Aaron, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how are you doing tonight?
Good. What's on your mind?
I'm a company driver for right now, and I'd really like to go ahead and buy my own truck. I've been doing this for 8 years. I'm only 29, and I just think it would be a good time to start. Maybe I'm wrong.
Now, as far as the economy goes and that kind of thing, I'm of the mind that there's never a bad time to get into business if you've got a good business plan, you're reasonably set financially, and you know what you're doing. Now, there's also never a good time to get into business if you don't do those things.
Right. Well, I'm not set, but I got 10 grand in the bank to start out and all that, and one of the things that my company does is, the company I'm working for now, is they lease their trucks from International. Okay, and they pay them $1,000 a month. It's a straight-up lease plus 10 cents a mile on how many miles we run. But the only time we have to do anything to the truck is if we break it. They take care of the tires. They can take care of all the maintenance, oil change, everything, service. Is that a good idea, and how would that work on my taxes?
I don't like full service leasing. I mean, as far as how it works on the taxes, it's pretty simple. You take everything you pay them as a tax deduction. That's pretty straightforward. But if we own a truck, we take everything we spend as a tax deduction as well. So there really isn't much difference. The only difference being depreciation, and I'm not going to get too deep into explaining the differences tax-wise, other than to say, either way, we're going to deduct everything we spend, so let's ignore taxes for a second and look at the deal. That's what's called almost called a full-service lease. It's very close to a full-service lease.
Right.
And I'm not a big fan of that, and here's why. International knows and needs to know that they're going to make money on the lease and also servicing that truck. I want to control that myself. I don't want to pay somebody else to make money by owning and maintaining a truck. International is going to make money because they own that truck and they maintain that truck. That's our job as an owner-operator, to own and maintain a truck, and that's how we make money. I don't want to share that part of the profit with anybody.
Right. The only reason I kind of thought about that, because a friend of mine is an owner-operator, and he actually pointed me towards you when I started talking about it, and I'm really glad he did, because I've learned a lot listening to your shows. But he pointed out how it works on the depreciation on the taxes, and I didn't really like it.
Well, I think he must have explained it wrong. Let me give you an example of how it really works. And I'm going to give you an example to point at. And here's what I always want you to remember, though. Whether we depreciate something or whether we lease something, we will always deduct every penny we spend. So they're the same in the end. The only difference is when we deduct what we spend. Now, in a lease, you can only deduct things when you actually spend the money, meaning I have to give that money to somebody else before I can deduct it. In a depreciation situation, when I buy something, I write it off when I decide based on the depreciation schedule, and it has nothing to do with when I spend it. So a depreciation, if I understand taxes and I have a good tax preparer, gives me more flexibility as far as when I make the tax deduction. So I would always rather depreciate things than lease them.
Okay.
If I'm a big fleet and I'm leasing 100 trucks at a time, then the game changes because the rules for depreciation change when I have that much equipment in service. But as a small owner-operator, somebody buying less than, let's say, 3 trucks in any given year, I would rather depreciate than lease. If I'm buying 5 or more trucks or acquiring 5 or more trucks in a year, then sometimes I might look at the lease because there's some rule changes. But I don't even like to try to describe them because everybody gets confused. So what I really say is, you know, the tax part of it is kind of an issue, but let's set it aside. It's not the big issue.
Okay. And my other question was, what's the most aerodynamic truck? Would you go with a T2000, a 386, or would you go with a Volvo or a Freightliner?
That one's easier because as long as you stick with the aerodynamic version of whatever truck you want to buy, whatever make you want to buy, you're going to be fine. We can't really measure the differences between a T2000 and a Columbia. They're both aerodynamic enough. So as long as you stick with the aerodynamic model, then just buy the truck that you like.
Okay.
If you get in a Kenworth and you really like a T2000 or a T600, then buy those. If you get in a Volvo and that's what you really like, then buy that. As far as aerodynamics, they're all close enough that it's not going to matter.
So a T600 and a 2000 ain't no difference. All right.
Not enough to matter, and there isn't enough difference between that and a Volvo to matter either.
Okay. I don't like Volvo, but okay. I'll keep that in mind.
Okay.
Appreciate you my call.
You're welcome, and that's really kind of what I'm talking about, is if you don't like the Volvo, then don't go buy the Volvo. Once you decide on an aerodynamic truck, then which one isn't going to matter nearly as much as picking one you like for whatever the reason might be. Hugh, you're up. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir. Hey, I'm curious about what?
What's up?
I just was going to use this forum as an opportunity to vent something about brokers, you know, nasty old brokers and their unfair practices.
Yeah.
I used to listen to the program on Road Dogg a lot called Landline Now, which is an OOIDA program. And,
right.
And I also used to be a member of OOIDA.
I many, many moons ago, I was too.
And the reason why I was a member of OOIDA is because they seem to be not only the biggest but the most effective organization at representing the truckers, the drivers themselves in Washington, D.C. And,
right.
And what I like most about them is they seem to be very conservative, very non-government intervention types, and just really looking out for us to keep the government off of our backs.
Right.
But now, when it comes down to the brokers, is when I started seeing sort of a change in the direction of their policies, their philosophies. I was listening to a show on Landline Now. It's probably been well over a year ago. And they were taking the brokers to task. As a matter of fact, I think it was the president of OIDA. I think his name is Jim Johnson. And
right.
And then also a representative from some brokers association. And the whole idea, the whole thing, that the argument was, is that, 100% of fuel surcharge needs to be passed on. And that brokers should be limited in how much they can make off of each load. And all the stuff that we hear from some of the members on the website. What really, really bothers me about that, and I hope you don't mind me just using your time to vent this, but OOIDA, if anybody, is in a prime position to collectively bargain with a group of brokers to become, what is it Dave Ramsey has, endorsed local providers. They could have something like OOIDA endorsed brokers to get to be one of these brokers that OOIDA has certified as doing business the way OOIDA wants them to do business.
That's
and then
great.
They have this. I mean, why would they want the government to come in and do something that they themselves are actually better suited to do in the private sector?
That particular point I've never thought about. That's a great point. Now, over the years, I have gone head-to-head with the WIDA about a lot of things. And people would always say, Kevin, why don't you just support OIDA? They're the only group out here pushing for owner-operators. They're the only group that could help us. And that was what I said. That's why I won't support them, because I think they're doing the wrong things too many times, and I don't want to lend my support to the wrong thing. And I kept saying, I think I just disagree with them in too many ways to lend that support. I don't want to support those kind of issues, and primarily – things like the Truck Act and fuel surcharges and brokers and rates and I'll go over a couple more that I haven't agreed with them. But you know what I finally realized just recently? I went back through all the things. I took it some time and I said, I want to look at when do I agree with them and when do I not agree with them? And it was such a distinct line that I can't believe I didn't realize it before. And you know what it is?
What is that?
If it's regulatory, having to do with laws, states as far as what they do on inspections, if they stick to the regulatory safety side of the issues.
Exactly. Which they usually
agree with them
so good at.
99% of the time, I almost always agree with them when they talk about the things that they've done to fight different state issues on inspections and, you know, recently they had the states around Minnesota and Wisconsin that were doing the out of service on the driver, you know,
right,
based on goofy tech. I agree with them almost 99% of the time if they stay on the regulatory side, and not always, but enough that I would get behind them. It's when they get to the economic side that we are 180 degrees apart, and I'm sorry, I can't support an organization that supports those kind of issues. I just can't ever. Until they either change the way they think about the economic side of this business and our economy, or stay out of it. If they did that, I'd be okay too. Just stay out of it. Don't go fight for things like the Truck Act. Stay on the safety side, and you know what? I might be standing there hand in hand with those guys.
They were outstanding. If I'm remembering correctly, it's been quite a few years ago, with the states of California and Tennessee, which were they were just absolutely abusing us out there on the road.
I would be behind them 100%. When they started suing our customers, I had a real problem with that, and I still do.
Yeah, see, I'm leased to Landstar. And I find at one point I was a member of OIDA and leased to Landstar. I finally had to make a choice.
Yeah.
I'm still at Landstar.
They were suing your only customer.
Yes, exactly. And on my behalf, supposedly.
Well, they were taking the poor me mentality. They were, and here's where we separated ways a long time ago. When I was a member until they started those lawsuits, and then I felt like they were saying, "Hey, look, everybody's out to screw you. Join us, and we'll screw them back." And that
understand.
In my opinion, that could have been OIDA's motto. Everybody's out to screw you. Join us, we'll screw them back.
I don't understand why they couldn't have just taken a more I can't come up with the right adverb here, but a stance that would be more, let's get the two parties together and work it out instead of let's sue somebody. Because,
yeah,
I mean, OIDA has this large group of drivers and leased to every company out there. It seems like a phone call says there seems to be a problem with your lease, you know, or
yep.
That, you know,
absolutely.
Some of your drivers are complaining about something. When can they get together and try to hash this out? No, the first thing they do is try to drag you into court. And I hate that about them.
Well, and it hasn't done any good. The lawsuits have been going on for 15 years. Here's what would have done some good. Exactly what you just said. Work with the carriers because we need them as owner-operators.
That's my customer. Don't go out there screwing my customer.
Now, here's the other thing they could have done. What about education? Just educate the owner-operators about what a good lease looks like, what a bad lease is, and we would have put far more carriers, bad carriers, out of business than we have by suing them, because by suing them, they really haven't put anybody out of business. So all those bad leases are still out there. If they would have taken the stance that we're going to educate our members and we are going to work with their customers to fix the problem, we would have fixed the problem. I think that they felt like they could get more members by saying, everybody's screwing you, let's screw them back. And it's the victimhood mentality that I just can't stand.
Yep, I hear you. We could all be company drivers if we didn't want to take responsibility for our own lives.
I'm not so sure that there wasn't, and this is more theory than anything, but when I look at what's going on, when you look at the issues in the ports, now the ports came in, the state of California and the Port Authority, and this is still going on, came in and started changing the rules. They made the equipment really expensive. Now, if it comes down to it, who can afford more expensive equipment, a big fleet or a small owner operator?
I'd say a big fleet.
Yeah. And then that wasn't even enough. I mean, I could tell where they were going with those regulations. Then they just came in and said, hey, you know what? You can't use independent contractors in the ports, period. We're not even going to screw around with trying to do this through the back door. We're just going to tell you can't use independent contractors in the ports.
Which is basically what they were wanting anyway, right?
Right. Now, is that a direct attack on our way of business?
Absolutely.
Owner, operator, independent driver association, why aren't they fighting that?
Got me. I quit trying to keep up with them.
I've looked all over. They're actually on the side of the Teamsters with that one out there, and the Teamsters are the ones that want the independent contractors out of the ports.
Oh, God.
I don't see a way to fight in this. Now, you know who is fighting it? And I'm certainly not always on the side of this organization. But they're the ones fighting it. They've got a lawsuit. They're saying you can't do this. You can't stop independent contractors from coming into the ports. I don't know why.
Discrimination or something. I mean, it violates the equal protection under the law.
It's anti-small business is what it is, because there will be nothing left in the ports except giant companies who can afford all the new equipment and hire employees only. And they will run the ports completely. And that is a direct attack on our way of business. And I can't believe we didn't hear more about that from OIDA.
Now, is that a state of California deal, or is that a federal deal with the ports of California?
It's state because it's a port. The state runs the port authority.
Yeah. Well, you know, California is just a microcosm of where the whole country is headed if we don't stop it.
That's what I'm afraid of. Good topic.
Okay. Hey, listen, I got one word for you.
What's that?
Fair tax now. I know it's not the right night, but I'll probably call back tomorrow.
We will be talking about that tomorrow, and I need to teach you math, because that's still three words every time I try saying it. We might be able to get away with combining fair tax into one new word, fair tax. You got to say it faster, fair tax. But once you throw in the now, it just can't be one word anymore. Let's go to Pennsylvania. Ralph, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin.
What's up?
You want some snow?
No, I don't. That's why I live in Florida this time of year.
Because I've got plenty here. Question, you were going off about when you started the show about the freight index.
Yes.
I got a question about that. Is that for just on the broker loads, or is that for all loads?
Good question. Actually, what it's called is the spot market load, which isn't that that takes up most of the broker stuff. And the load board stuff, and even some shipper stuff, is considered spot market. The kind of the definition of spot market is something that isn't moved under contract. So it's the stuff that we're negotiating every day kind of stuff. And those rates are typically put together from the two big load boards, Internet Truck Stop and DAT, D-A-T, Transcor. They're the two biggest, and we're talking about millions of loads that they put these numbers together with, but it is what's called the spot market, not stuff moving under contract.
So there's probably, you know, that number would be a lot higher with stuff under contract.
I don't know if the number would be higher. The number would be different, and I don't follow. In fact, I haven't been able to find a source of the numbers and what's going on with contracted stuff, because it never gets posted anywhere. If I go into a shipper and I negotiate a contracted rate with them for this particular load for the next 12 months, well, that rate's between the shipper and myself, and I don't even know where to find those numbers. So it may not be higher. It would be different, but I don't know what it would be. It could be that if I negotiated a rate, let's say 6 months ago, I negotiated a rate for a year, those contracts would tend to bring the rate number down, because 6 months ago the rates were even lower, and I locked in for a year.
And now with most of like the Northeast is shut down, the rates, the numbers is going to change for that also, right?
You mean because of the weather?
Yeah. I-81's been shut down most of this afternoon, you know.
Yeah.
Most of Pennsylvania's shut down, yeah.
We will see that effect in the short term in the weekly reports. We'll see that effect. And what you'll typically see is the first week, load availability, the number will drop way off because shippers aren't even going to bother posting loads if they know they can't move them. Trucks may or may not change, and then the following week you'll probably see a spike the other way because all that freight that didn't get moved now needs to get moved.
Trust me, I wouldn't be in this area if I didn't have to.
Yeah,
I'd rather be down in Florida like I was last week.
Yeah, there you go.
That was my question. Thanks.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Yeah, I'd like to spend more time on rates because I think that when you start to understand them, it's more interesting and you can watch the trends and see what's going on. I'm going to get to another call here. If you want to join in, press 1 on your phone and Lisa will be right with you. She'll screen your call and we'll get you on the air. We can talk about whatever you want. We don't have to talk about OIDA or rates. It's just what I opened up the show with because I want to get back to bringing the rates to you on a regular basis so you can kind of follow them and see what's going on. But tonight we can talk about anything that you want. Let's go to Ohio. Don, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
I'm doing good. What's on your mind?
I'm just curious. Do you think the electronic foot pedal in an 08 Caterpillar would make it kind of miss and make the injection seem like it's sometimes working half, like 50%, and then you push down on the pedal a little bit, and it will make it, like, lunge into all the power, all the cylinders firing good, and stuff like that. Do you think that would be possible in that?
Yes, it is possible. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if that's what's going on, but that can absolutely cause that because, you know, if you think about what's going on in today's engines with what we call the throttle position sensor, prior to electronic engines, we had mechanical linkage. And if the mechanical linkage wasn't broke, when you pushed on one end, something moved on the other end. And when it was broke,
right,
because it's mechanical, you could look at it and see what was broke usually. With electronic engines and what's called a throttle position sensor, there is no mechanical linkage. That sensor needs to be able to register where your pedal is in order to know what to do with the engine, what to do with timing and fuel injection and all those other things. And if there's any electronic problem anywhere in the system, whether it's the throttle position sensor itself, a wire anywhere in between, a connection anywhere in between, somewhere at the ECM, any electrical interruption can screw up what the engine, what signal it's getting from that foot pedal. So if all of a sudden the signal is interrupted completely, the engine might have a split second where it thinks you just let off the throttle, and how's the engine going to act? No fuel. And the opposite happens. So yeah, that throttle position sensor can have a big effect on what's going on with the engine. And what I've found, and I don't know why, the throttle position sensor seems to be one of those items that doesn't necessarily throw a code when it's going bad. So when mechanics go in and look for codes and they say, well, we don't have any codes, many times I've seen that it's called the TPS. I've seen the TPS not throw a code even though it's going bad.
Yeah, there's been no codes, and it idles fine. It runs good at full throttle when you're pushing down to shift the gears. Where you really notice it is you're letting the clutch out to take off, and if you're just going to dink around in first gear, maybe second,
right,
parking lot situation or something, and you're maybe you're pushing on the throttle a little bit, trying to get it up to 900, 1100 RPM, it will run great on all six cylinders. Sometimes it feels like it runs on three cylinders, four, you know, half,
right,
of all six cylinders.
Yeah. I tend to look for the electronic reasons for those kind of things first, because digging into the mechanical reasons that could cause that are pretty costly. And if you get somebody who's pretty good at diagnosing, looking at the electronic reasons is less expensive and usually much quicker. You know, if we suspect a throttle position sensor, we should be able to test for it. If we expect an ECM, we can test for it. We can do that cheaper than we can digging into injectors or, you know, into the head to see if that's where the problem is. And it sounds to me like this one is electronic, the
is
problem.
The throttle positioning sensor is in the cab. It's underneath my foot. Is that where it is?
It is. It's under your foot, and sometimes the engine shops don't even like to mess with them. That's another problem. When I had Detroits, and I had a Ford with a Detroit, and that I bet I replaced that throttle position sensor 6 times in like 1.3 million miles, and every time it's one of the reasons I finally figured out that it was a problem, because Detroit would take them a while to identify it, and once they identified it, they wouldn't replace it. I had to take it somewhere else to get that replaced. They wouldn't do it.
Yeah. Well, I listened to a program last night on the radio, the Midnight Show, and it was recorded earlier because I heard you mention something about not being, you know, this is recorded. But a guy called up, and he had an 08 Caterpillar, and he'd been to 14 different shops, and his boost pressure was going up and down, up and down.
Right.
I don't know if you remember that. But
yeah,
mine will do that too, and that really caught my ear when he started to talk like that, and I said, well, mine will do that. I mean, I'd just be going down the highway, and all of a sudden the valve train, you know, you got the Caterpillar clatter, I call it, and the valve train is loud, and then it will just, it'll silence out and get kind of quiet, and the boost will go up. It does that when it goes into the regen.
You know, on that call, I don't think I even mentioned throttle position sensor, and that could be what's going on with it.
Yeah, you didn't. But I was talking to my shop this morning, and I didn't know it, but they've replaced 3 or 4 of them in different trucks already.
Okay.
The way mine is.
Yeah, it's one of those things that over the years I have replaced several, not so much anymore. My Volvos don't seem to do it as much as some of the other trucks I used to have, but that is definitely the way some of them will act. So it's certainly something to look at. Let's go to South Carolina this time. Tony, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. What's on your mind?
Oh, Ida, now that y'all brought it up, when you start with Landstar, I like Landstar. I think they're a good company. I was leased to them for 3 years. Don't have any gripes with them, but you talk about them suing Landstar. They did go to talk to Landstar, and from what I understand, they went and talked to pretty much everybody before they sued them. And, of course, the big companies aren't going to change anything unless somebody forces them to. And they hurt their sales when they sue most of these companies, just like with Landstar. A lot of their owner-operators had a lot of their insurance with OIDA. And once OIDA sued them, Landstar changed their insurance to where they couldn't get it from OIDA anymore. So they knew they was going to hurt themselves before they done it. They didn't do it just because they want to go and sue people. They do it to help.
They didn't know because Landstar is the only one that's changed their insurance. So why they didn't see that coming? They didn't know that, and they didn't go to him first. And let's go way back in history on this. And you're on the right track, but I think most people miss what the lawsuits were really all about. And this is what bothers me more than anything. When you look at the lawsuits, and let's talk about this one in particular. OIDA came in and said, you can't do X, meaning you can't take money out of an owner-operator settlement and not tell them how much you paid for the item. You have to tell them what you paid for the item before you deduct any money from them, whether it's insurance. You can't hold back fees. You can't upcharge things. That's what this was all about. And I have a problem with that because the Truth in Leasing Act already says The carrier can't force you to buy something from the carrier. They can offer it, but they can't force you. And I'm okay with that. Let's just enforce that law. So now if the carrier offers me insurance and I look at the rate, I don't care what they have to pay for that insurance. I only care about the rate they're offering to me, and I can go somewhere else and shop around, and I can choose to buy insurance somewhere else, or I can choose to buy it from my carrier. I don't want the carrier to have to tell me what they paid for it. That's anti-business. That was part of the lawsuit. Fuel cards, fuel discounts, all those things. Now, let's think about that. Every one of the lawsuits had something to do with carriers providing a service to owner-operators, correct? Either providing them with a fuel card, providing them with insurance, providing them with tire discounts. Those were all the things that were fought in the lawsuits, right?
Those and charges that they charged the drivers that the drivers didn't want.
Then don't take it. It's your choice. That's the point. You had the option. The Truth in Leasing Act already covered that. But
when the carrier like Landstar did changed the insurance to where the only place that you could buy it just about was through them. There were a couple of other places, but the main place was through them. It was the way they changed it was the cheapest place that you could buy it.
So what's wrong with that? That gives me the best deal.
If they would leave it like most of the other carriers, you could buy it cheaper somewhere else. It was just cheaper at Landstar because of the things that they put in it. All the other insurance companies had to charge a whole lot higher rate.
Because it was better coverage, and that's what they wanted. They wanted better coverage. I don't have a problem with that because I still have many choices. I can either go get my insurance somewhere else, or I can choose not to lease to Landstar if I don't like their insurance policies. That's just competitive business. But what's anti-competitive, here's what I don't like. Here's the anti-competitive part. OIDA comes in and sues all these carriers for providing services to owner-operators. How does OIDA make all its money?
They make some of their money off of lawsuits. I know where you're going.
No, you don't. They don't make any money off their lawsuits. They spend a fortune on those lawsuits. They don't make any money. That's not where I'm going. OIDA doesn't make any money from memberships either. Not when you talk about $25 a year and look at the building they're in. And I'm okay with them making a boatload of money. But I want them to be honest about them, and I want them to not use our court system the way they're using it. OIDA makes all their money selling services to owner-operators, whether it's fuel discount programs, health insurance, truck insurance, fuel tax, whatever, all of their services. Now, if they sue a bunch of carriers and carriers now become afraid to offer those same services to owner-operators because they're getting sued for it, who's left to provide that service?
A million different insurance companies and OIDA.
But not the carrier anymore.
Well, I mean, the carrier's a carrier. They shouldn't be in the insurance business to begin with.
I want them to be. I want my carrier in that business. It's the very best deal for me. That FedEx, Landstar, just about everywhere you go. They have all the buying power. I want that advantage as an owner-operator. At least give me the choice. Let the carrier go out and work the best deal they can on my behalf. And then if I don't like that deal, I'll go elsewhere. I have that choice. Don't take away one of my choices. That's what they did.
I mean, you sound like that's the exact same thing the government is trying to do right now, the health insurance, is what you're saying, which I'm totally against also. They want to make health insurance where they'll give it to you cheaper because they're going to say exactly what's going to be in that health insurance policy. And then they're going to offer it to you at a cheaper price than any insurance company can because of what they put in the insurance policy so that you'll come and buy the insurance through them because they're the cheaper one. They're not the best one to get it from. The other insurance companies would be better to get it from under most circumstances.
ever heard me support those government regulations? I've been fighting those from day one. I'm completely.
I know you have, but this is the exact same thing, and you want to support the carriers because you're not thinking about it.
What do you mean? I want to support the carriers as an option. Don't take away my option, because for me, it's my best option. But I'm not.
Right. Well, nobody's taking away your option.
Yes, they are. The carriers stopped providing services. And let me tell you another one that hurt us big time, because the lawsuit said if you're going to provide an owner-operator with a product, you have to tell the owner-operator what you paid for the product. Now, let me tell you how that hurts. Let's say I have 100 trucks, and I go to Michelin, and I say, Michelin, look, you guys sell a tire for $300 on the open market, but I have 100 trucks, so I want a discount. You know, you need to give me a 5% discount because I'm going to buy tires for 100 trucks. That makes sense. Happens all the time. Now, carrier B comes in, and they have 1,000 trucks. And carrier B says, hey, look, we've got 1,000 trucks. We want a discount, and we know that you're giving a 5% discount to them. We want a 10% discount. Now, 10,000 trucks comes in. They want a 50% discount. Michelin and every other vendor out there writes into their contracts, if we provide you with a discount, you can't disclose it. Because if you disclose your discount on 100 trucks, by the time we get to 10,000 trucks, we lose money on our tires, and we don't want everybody to negotiate against us based on the discounts they know about. So you are not allowed to disclose your discount. Now carriers are being forced to disclose those discounts, and the vendors are saying, we can't discount anymore. We're not going to do it. We can't do this if you are going to disclose what you're discounting to everybody else, because we no longer have any negotiating power. Now, who does that hurt? That hurts us.
That would hurt the owner operator. I mean, I've never run into that. I mean, Landstar still gives plenty of discounts to their owner operators. The main thing that I've heard of through OWIDA is all of the chargeback that they are charging back to the owner operator, and they want them to be truthful. They want to be truthful about the chargebacks that they're giving, not the discounts, not things that they're helping them with.
Every chargeback was right in the contract. I read the contracts. I dealt with the settlements for years. I've done accounting for over 15 years. I get to see everybody's settlements. There was nothing in there that you didn't know about. That's my point. But that wasn't enough. The lawsuits say you have to disclose the price the carrier paid for the item. And that is anti-business, and it's the same thing as saying the broker has to disclose what he's got in the load. That's anti-business. That's what I'm against.
Right. I agree with you on that.
Good. I'm glad you agree.
I understand that.
On the regulatory side, I am with them most of the time. I'm with them enough that I would support them on the regulatory side. I am just 180 degrees against them on the economic side of the issues.
I mean, OWIDA helps owner-operators just about every single day on the economic side of it.
No, on the regulatory side. On the economic side, they're hurting us.
No, they help every day on the economic side. They'll help you get your money back from a broker that don't want to pay.
Oh, come on. Let me tell you something. I had a dispute with somebody it had nothing to do with brokers or loads or anything like that. I had a financial dispute with a client. And right or wrong, you know, that might ultimately have to be decided in a court. But that client went to OWIDA and said, this company is screwing me, and I want you to do something about it. And OWIDA called me up and kind of explained the situation, and I laughed at them and hung up the phone. They have zero authority to do anything. Nothing.
That's totally wrong, Kevin. There's thousands of owner-operators that could call in and tell you that you're totally wrong on that. I've used OWIDA on it twice and got a turnaround from the carrier both times within days. And I know personally at least five other owner-operators that has done the same thing. When OIDA calls them, they jump to it and pay you right then just about.
What was the issue? Tell me what they got you money back for.
They got me money on a bill that hadn't been paid.
Well, that's collections. I mean, that's a legitimate bill that's due.
That's true, yeah. And there are plenty of companies out there that don't want to pay it when it's due. And OIDA gets on it, and they pay it. That's economic.
Yeah, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about economic issues that will affect us. Why aren't they fighting for owner-operators to stay in the port?
It affects us a whole lot.
And that's okay. That's a service they provide. And providing services, whether it's insurance or collections or authority, I have no problem with them providing the services. I like it as a choice because I'm all about choice. Don't take away my choices. So if they want to go out and compete in those services to provide them, I'm all for it. What I don't want them doing is using the court system to stop somebody else from providing those same services or to intimidate somebody into not providing those same services. I am all for letting them compete for that business. And when they are competitive, then absolutely, I will be right there with them. All right. I've got a couple more minutes left in the show. If anybody wants to join in, raise your hand. We've got some open lines. I know we got off. And you know what? That's what I like about this show. We can get off on those kind of rants. I can't always do that on the live show. So if you're listening and you don't like that kind of stuff, that's probably going to happen. This is probably going to happen a lot more on the podcasted shows. If you've got a question, I'll certainly get to it. Raise your hand. We've got some time to do it. I see a bunch of hands going up now. Lisa will get right to you. This is the call-in show, so the callers will absolutely determine where we go with topics. Tomorrow night is the Pit, Politics in Trucking. We are talking about the fair tax. Everything you ever wanted to know about the fair tax. I have blocked out all my – I'm pretty up on the fair tax. I've been supporting it for years. I've read both books that are out about the fair tax. I've talked about it. I have a strong tax background, so I understand our current tax system and how it works, and I think that helps me understand how the fair tax will work as well. But even with all that, tomorrow I told everybody – my phones are off, not checking my email, locking myself in a room, and I am reading and brushing up on fair tax all day tomorrow. So if you have a question about fair tax, by all means, join in tomorrow. Same time, same phone number, all that good stuff. It will be a free forum. You can talk about the free tax. You can ask questions about the free tax. We can argue about the free tax, just like tonight. But, you know, if you want to argue about rates, brokers, OIDA, it's wide open. We don't, for now, there really aren't any commercial breaks in this show. That may have to change a little bit in the future. It will never get to the point where the hour is loaded up with a bunch of commercials. But just looking at costs on this, I may eventually have to bring in a sponsor or two, maybe open up the show with a minute commercial, maybe do a minute at the bottom, something like that, just to help cover costs because this is already getting expensive. But it's a lot of fun. I really like it. I appreciate everybody who's joining in with this. Let's go to another call before I do run out of time. Let's go to Ron. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How are you tonight?
I'm doing good. What's up?
Hey, just a quick question. What do you consider like a base cost of operation per mile? You know, is it – I know we have our fixed costs with truck payments, insurance payments, this and that, and fuel is always variable.
Right.
You know, I've heard people say anywhere from 75 cents to 90 cents a mile, you know, and that doesn't include any driver's wages or anything.
Yeah, the range is even bigger than that. And
okay.
And that's the key, is that range is really big, and that's our job as a smart business owner to keep that number as low as we can. That's our job.
Sure.
I mean, if we want to be successful, we keep our cost of operation as low as we possibly can, then we make more money even at the same rate. So when, you know, I always find it funny when, you know, I say things like there's no such thing as cheap freight, and I know that makes people crazy. But a guy who's pulling freight for $1.50 a mile and says that $1.30 a mile is cheap, but it turns out his cost is $1 a mile and mine's 65 cents. So if I have 65 cent cost and pull freight at $1.30, who's really pulling cheaper freight, him or I?
Right, definitely. Yeah, you're coming out farther ahead in the long run.
Yeah, he's pulling cheaper freight. He just doesn't like the fact that I can compete against him, cut his rate, move the freight cheaper, but I still make more money. Well, that's a no-brainer. Why wouldn't I do it?
Yep.
And you know what? I love having those guys around. I like it when they stay in business because they tend to drive the rate back up some, which is okay for me because I still have lower cost and I make more money. But that's what business is all about. It's driving your cost down as low as you can and then providing the best service at the best price.
Right. Yep. Okay. I've got two company trucks and a couple owner operators. I operate under my own authority and just I love your radio show. This is the first night I've listened to your podcast. This is the information you give is very, very helpful.
I appreciate it. And boy, I'll tell you what, the time just flew by. We're down to just about 3 minutes, and now I have calls all over the place. Let's go to Derek. Welcome to the program.
How are you tonight, Kevin?
I'm doing good. What's on your mind?
Oh, I just wanted to talk about brokers. I don't understand why everybody thinks that everybody's got to regulate them. I run underneath my own authority.
Right.
And ever stuff. And I don't have a problem. If you don't like the rate they're willing to give you, move on to the next one. There's lots of them out there. And there's good rates out there. You just got to shop around and find them.
Here's the other thing, because you're absolutely correct. But the other thing we have to realize is that if you randomly call brokers looking for loads, you should expect to get the worst possible rates to move freight. If I'm a broker, and I've been there, I've done this, you call me out of the blue. I don't know you at all. I'm not going to give you my best rate. I'm not going to give you my best freight. Now, if you've developed a relationship with me and now we've done business together three or four or five times, and I see that, wow, you're good to talk to on the phone, so I can expect that you'll be good like that when you get to my customers. I've asked my customer when you came in, what was the experience like? And they tell me you were clean and dressed well, truck was good, you didn't give anybody on the dock a hard time, freight got delivered on time. Now I'm going to seek out your services, and I'm going to start paying you more for them because you're good for my business and you're good for my customers. When I don't know you, I'm going to get away with giving you the worst freight I've got at the lowest rate I can get until you prove yourself. So on the other end of that, as an owner-operator or somebody in your position, you want to work with brokers and develop relationships with them, not try to do the one loads when, you know, and sometimes you have to, but you also have to expect that's not where you're going to get your best rates.
No, it's not. And that's what I kind of didn't explain myself very well, but that's what I was trying to say is you shop around. If you set yourself in lanes and places you like to go, you'll get a handful of people you like to use everywhere.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Explained, the more you use that same broker, you know, they get good reports on the other end if you're doing a good job for them. Yeah, and the second, third time you use them, you get a little better rate, and you keep asking them for a little more until finally they'll tell you, I don't have any more to give you.
Right, right. No, I was agreeing with you completely. I think you've got the right idea on this, and I think you're doing it the way you need to do it to be successful. The people who complain about brokers tend to be the ones who don't develop those relationships, who randomly make calls and then wonder why they can't negotiate. Because, again, when I had the loads, I didn't negotiate with people that I didn't know. I'm just, here's my rate. You know, move it, prove yourself, then we'll talk maybe next time. And the more we do that, the more I'll negotiate with you. But in the beginning, I'm not taking the risk. That's my customer, and I'm all out of time. Thanks, everybody, for joining me. I'll see you in 30 minutes on the air. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Good night, everyone.